Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 99, an old world update. It's been a long time since we looked at what was going on back in Europe. We've touched upon the wars of religion raging there, as well as Spain's battles in Italy and Iberian campaigns in North Africa. We've usually done this when introducing conquistadors and outlining their previous history. I haven't really talked much about what was going on there, though, and I have referred to the king when relevant, without giving him a name or any detail. Things are about to change in Iberia, and this will have an effect on the development of Latin America. It seems like a good idea to do one of our periodic update episodes, to explain what was going on in the background over there, and to outline what will be happening in the coming years. The Spanish king, who conquistadors had appealed to when trying to solidify their rights to new territory, and who sometimes sent his own men over from Spain, was Charles V. Around the time that Valdivia was being killed in battle in Chile, 3 years later to be precise, he decided to abdicate and to pass the throne on to his son. He had ruled for 39 years, and his time in power had seen huge growth in the Spanish Empire. When he took charge, only the Caribbean islands and Panama were under their control. The world-changing conquests of the Aztec and the Inca had happened during his reign, as well as all the others we've covered since Balboa's time in Panama. Despite this, I think it's fair to say that his primary focus was still Europe. The colonies were a means to improve his ability to engage with politics and wars on his home continent. His first concern was the war with France, largely played out in northern Italy. Soon he had another major conflict to deal with as well, those wars for the future of Christianity, which were affecting France and were starting to rage across the rest of Western Europe. Protestantism is most traditionally said to have started when Martin Luther nailed his arguments against the Catholic Church to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg in eastern Germany. There had been people who broke from the church before. They were usually labelled as heretics and persecuted. This was different. It caught on, and soon leaders of the hundreds of tiny states in Central Europe were converting and defying the Pope's hegemony on Christianity. Other religious philosophers followed and gained converts as well, like John Calvin, whose followers we met in French Brazil. Because, as well as being the Spanish king, he was also the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles's territory was the cradle of the Reformation. It was the place where Protestantism was born. Charles was extremely Catholic, and he waged the wars against the Protestants with extreme enthusiasm. His list of titles is extensive. He was also Duke of Austria and of Burgundy. This last title gave him control of today's Netherlands and Belgium, something which will soon become important. He was actually in control of this territory for a few years before becoming King of Spain, and he generated resentment amongst his Spanish subjects because he seemed to prefer it up there. He'd been born in today's Belgium and usually appointed people from there to important positions rather than Spaniards. He spent a lot of his life travelling all over the place to keep an eye on his possessions, so we really should think of him as a European ruler rather than a purely Spanish one, setting a precedent which will be followed by Spanish rulers for centuries to come. He never travelled to Latin America. I think this demonstrates his priorities. The religious wars are messy and complex, but a major step towards peace came in 1555, when a treaty was signed which allowed the various princes and rulers within the Holy Roman Empire to continue to follow the most prominent form of Protestantism, thus ending the conflict with them. It seems that by this point, Charles was done with the constant fighting, travelling, and the wider responsibilities which came with ruling such a disparate collection of territories. He actively tried to give up control of places, giving the Holy Roman Empire, Switzerland and Northern Italy to a relative, thus splitting these parts off from the Spanish, Southern Italian and Low Country possessions, which would form the core of his direct family lands. His surname was Habsburg, as was that of the relatives he gave his Central and Eastern European possessions to. That branch of the family will rule in Austria until the First World War. Those places he did hold on to, he soon started giving away to his son, until he personally had nothing left. He retired to a monastery in Spain, and 2 years later he died of malaria. His son, Philip II, took control of what remained. Partly because of the loss of the Central European territories, and partly because he was born and raised in Spain, he thought of himself as much more Spanish than his father. And so the country will form the core of his territory and receive much more attention. One way in which he resembled his father, though, was his devotion to Catholicism. As we shall see shortly, the war against Protestantism might be largely over, but Philip found a new outlet for his piousness, so that his attention didn't extend to the Latin American colonies as much as they might have liked. The grinding, drawn-out war with France will end quickly after Philip takes power. They were technically a series of wars, which lasted for over 50 years. They predated King Charles, even. Their reasons are complex and not really relevant to us, but they grew out of rivalries between Italian city-states, who managed to bring France and Spain, / the Holy Roman Empire, in to support them, as well as other powers at times, like England, the Pope, and the Ottoman Empire. The good news from a Spanish point of view was that at the time we have reached in this podcast, this conflict was finally about to end. We saw in the episode on the French colony in Brazil that France was becoming afflicted by the wars over religion. They were now causing internal conflict. This was part of the reason it no longer felt able to engage in these external battles. The politics of Europe at the time are so complex that this is a huge simplification, but for our purposes it will do. The point is, Spain should now have been free to devote more time to other things, like the Americas. They were no longer fighting France or the Protestants of Central Europe. This must have been a relief. But these wars were soon replaced by others. The peoples of the lowlands had decided that they were fed up with being ruled from distant Spain. They were their own people, or collection of related peoples more accurately, and they wanted a state of their own. Part of their motivation was the fact that many of them were now Protestant. Their campaign for independence was long and drawn out. It's usually referred to not as the War of Independence, but as the 80 Years' War. It was also quite a brutal conflict. Years ago, I studied in the city of Leiden, halfway between Amsterdam and The Hague. It was the scene of one of the most gruesome episodes of this war, the Siege of Leiden. The Spanish surrounded the city, trapping its inhabitants inside for a whole year. They had been told that every single one of them would be killed if they surrendered, so they held on in desperation, with little hope of relief. 8,000 died from starvation and plague. The mayor is said to have told people that they could resort to eating their own arms if they could find nothing else. They broke the dikes and canals they used to irrigate their farmlands and to stop the whole low-lying region from being flooded by the North Sea. This was a way of keeping the Spanish at bay, but of course a side effect was that they ruined their crops. In the end, help did come, and the Dutch troops brought bread and herring to the famished population. Even today, the 3rd of October is a massive party in Leiden, where you can hardly move around the beautiful old streets and canals because of all the people celebrating, drinking, and listening to music being played on the outdoor stages, as well as eating the free herrings which the council provides. If you ever get a chance, it's worth going to see it. But this story also gives an idea of the deprivations which people had to endure during the long conflict, and how it focused the attentions of Spain away from other things. On top of this, Spain was drawn into another conflict during Philip's reign. They had long been interfering in North Africa. Usually they were the invaders. But things were beginning to change in that region. The Ottoman Empire was becoming extremely powerful. And while they were based in Turkey, the Middle East and the Balkans, they came to be the patrons of Muslim states in the wider area. In those parts of North Africa, where the Iberians had not taken control, a culture of piracy grew up. These pirates were often individuals, but just as often, the raids were led by the actual rulers of the states they came from. Their states were funded by these raids, and by the growing Barbary slave trade. At this point, this trade was largely focused on the coasts of Italy, Malta, and southern Spain. But later, they will reach as far as Ireland and Iceland. In parts of Europe, as a way of protecting themselves, people stopped living on the coast. Obviously, the rulers of Europe wanted to stop this. But driving them further into conflict was the fact that these pirate leaders and their states were closely connected to the Ottoman Empire. Philip organized a coalition, which became known as the Holy League, and included Genoa, Venice, Savoy, some of the crusading orders of knights, and the Pope. The name gives away the fact that he saw this not just as a geopolitical endeavour, but also a religious one against the Muslim Ottoman. Wars in North Africa and the Mediterranean will demand attention for decades.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals. Happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. This was all very far away from Latin America, but it did mean that, like his father, Philip had a constant and pressing need for money to fight these wars. We are speculating here. It may be that the Latin American colonies would have always been used as cash cows. But I think we can say that this drawn-out need for money over both Charles and Philip's reigns, which happened at the very beginning of their existence, meant that Latin America's colonies would be constructed in such a way that wealth could be easily extracted from them, rather than places to be developed in themselves. This model of colonial society will be solidified long after these wars are finished. While much of the wealth of Latin America was poured into armies, or found its way to independent merchants, often not even Spanish ones, it did have an effect on Spain itself. The coming years, and those when Charles had ruled, are often referred to as the Spanish Golden Age. This is partly because of their rapid expansion when it came to territory under their control, but also because of the funding which found its way into the arts and culture. This is the time when Don Quixote was written, when painters like Diego Velázquez and El Greco produced their most famous works. The Alhambra was renovated, and numerous other architects, sculptors, artists, and writers flourished. When we last looked at Iberia, Portugal's king was Manuel I. He sponsored Vasco da Gama to make his way around the bottom of Africa and open up Asia for Portuguese traders and colonists. During his reign, they took control of various forts in India, the Persian Gulf, and the East African coast. They established trade deals with China and Persia as well, and the country started to grow rich. Partly because of this, and partly because of their position on the edge of the continent, Portugal was not caught up in European affairs in the same way as Spain. Manuel was succeeded in 1521 by his son João III. His reign was more difficult. Manuel's policy had been to expand as much as possible in Asia, and this required borrowing money. The idea had been that it would be worth the investment, and it had been. As I said, the country had grown rich from their trade. The state itself, though, was in debt, and they were starting to have problems administering these distant, widespread territories efficiently. Just as had happened in Spanish America, governors started fighting each other for control of colonies. They were able to do so because they were so far from the watchful eye of Lisbon. Travelling around the southern edge of the Arabian Peninsula brought them into competition with the Ottoman Empire, as they encroached into its sphere of influence from the other side, to the usual borderlands in Europe and North Africa. They found themselves having to spend increasing amounts to defend their new territories. They still expanded where they could, however, taking control of the all-important Spice Islands in today's Indonesia. They also made contact with Japan and established trade there, something dramatized as part of the recent Shogun TV series. In Europe, they remained neutral in the wars we've covered earlier in this episode, but they committed themselves to Catholicism. Missionaries and conversion efforts became an important part of their empire. The biggest problem of João's reign came when he died. His son and heir had married into the Spanish royal family, but he, like the rest of João's children, died early. The only member of the family the throne could pass to was his child grandson, Sebastião. He was only 3 when he became king. He was obviously assisted in running things until he had grown up, and so the country continued on the same path as it had done under his grandfather. When he was old enough to take power, he promised to be an excellent king. At least, this is what the legend which grew up around him holds. There isn't that much to go on, because his reign was a short one. His main ambition was to take control of Morocco, and politics there gave him an opportunity. As I mentioned earlier, These North African states were independent, but heavily connected to the Ottoman Empire. There was a conflict about who would take over Morocco between an uncle, backed by the Ottoman, and his nephew, who came to Portugal for help to balance out his rival's powerful allies. Sebastião saw an opportunity and immediately launched into a war on behalf of his new candidate. His plan was presumably to exercise a large amount of control over the nominally independent nephew once they had driven the uncle out. Sebastião was extremely energetic and ambitious, charging into projects and allergic to procrastination. These traits probably would have made him a good king, but it's hard to know. They were the same traits which led to his demise. Landing in Morocco, he led an army inland, into a battle which took place a bit south of Tangiers. They lost this battle badly, and apparently Sebastião was seen charging into the enemy forces on horseback, with no regard for his own personal safety. This was the last time he was ever seen. The legend, which I mentioned grew up around him, is based on the fact that his body was never found. It holds that he is not dead, and that one day he will return to save Portugal in its time of need, just as King Arthur is supposed to be living under a mountain and will one day return to save England. Sebastião showed lots of promise in his short reign, but the mythology which surrounded him after his death held that he was the best king Portugal had ever seen, tragically prevented from achieving everything he was going to achieve. A bit like when rock stars die young, and this turns out to be the best thing they could do for their career. There was another motive to mourn what could have been among those who wanted a strong, independent Portugal, because of what came next. Detractors could say that Sebastião had been irresponsible, something which does not make a good king, because of his disregard for his personal safety, and because the issue of inheritance, which had brought him to power, had not been solved. Perhaps he should have dealt with that before going to Morocco. He hadn't had time to marry, and now there was no obvious heir at all. He had been an unlikely candidate to begin with. His 66-year-old granduncle was the only member of the family who was around to take over. This tenuous but best available candidate had a couple of flaws when it came to stabilizing the kingdom. Never expecting to come close to the throne, he had become a cardinal, a member of the church, and thus he had never married or had children. Portugal would face the same problem yet again when he died. His age was also an issue. He won't be alive to rule the kingdom for very long. So, of course, then there was another succession crisis, or you could say a continuation of the pre-existing one. Three grandchildren of King Manuel all had equal and weak claims to rule Portugal. The interlinked and complex marriages of European royalty meant that one of these grandchildren was Philip, the King of Spain we met earlier. They all began to fight each other to resolve the issue, but with the power of the wider Spanish Empire behind him, Philip won. In a huge and unexpected plot twist, Spain and Portugal were now united. They will remain so for 60 years, and over the reigns of three successive kings. This arrangement feels dramatic, partly because Portugal is today an independent nation, and because it had all of its overseas colonies. It wasn't unique, though. I've been talking about Spain as one unit, but at the time, it was actually still a union of the technically separate kingdoms of Castile and Aragon. Aragonese territory included Catalonia, and a lot of people there still consider themselves today culturally different to Spain, as much so as Portugal, and many want independence. Almost the same thing happened in Britain not too long afterwards. The crowns of Scotland and England were combined in one person, and this stuck. It's the origins of the United Kingdom which exists today. So if it wasn't for contingent quirks of history, It might be the Portuguese people campaigning for independence from Spain, as well as, or instead of, Catalonia. Philip continued to rule the United Territories from Spain, but Portugal did have autonomy to run its own affairs. The colonies of the two nations were kept separate, even if technically they had one ultimate boss. The Union didn't mean too much for Latin America, and didn't have that much of an impact on its development. It made the Treaty of Tordesillas less relevant, in one way, because the borderline between Spanish and Portuguese colonies was less important now. In truth, though, neither power had expanded enough yet to create border friction anyway. It didn't have an effect on the provisions of the treaty, which excluded the other European powers. But as we saw in French Brazil, this was starting to be ignored anyway. In addition to the precedent set by the French in Brazil, there is another way in which European politics we have covered today affected Latin America and encouraged the arrival of other powers. I mentioned last time how the French incursion into Brazil had started to make Portugal take it a bit more seriously. I also mentioned, however, that they didn't take it that seriously. It's possible that part of the reason for this was that Portugal became the secondary power in this union. Brazil became the easiest target for other Europeans. For those Dutch rebels, Portuguese territory now became fair game. They had a trading tradition, and this inspired their tiny country to build a large colonial empire of their own over the coming centuries. They began doing this before they had even finished winning their independence. Their merchants used to trade with the Portuguese, but now this was prohibited, as they had become enemies after the Union. They had to go out and find sources for the goods they'd bought from Portuguese merchants for themselves, and they also were happy to defy Portuguese claims and establish a colony in Brazil. This will prove longer lasting than the French one had, and it will control a much bigger area. It is another speculative what if, but perhaps they would have chosen somewhere else if it wasn't for the combination of the War of Independence from Spain, the Iberian Union, and the relative neglect of Brazil providing an opportunity. If you've enjoyed this podcast and you feel like helping out, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts really helps new people discover the podcast. If you've really, really enjoyed it and you're feeling generous, it is possible to make a small donation. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of those things. And thank you to everyone for listening.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsargent.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica. And that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @historylatinam, and if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsargentphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.